2:00, it's time to start. Well, there goes the formality, just so I introduce everybody. On the far left, you have Mike King from the southeast region. Next, him, Bill Fenimore from the northern region. Lee Kirkin from the north region also. Myself, Del Brady from the northeast. Assistant Director Mike Bow to substituting for Director Sheehan.
Temporary.
On the far right is Jake Albrecht from the southern region. Do we have any discussion on the agenda, or are we ready to approve that agenda as out?
Motion to approve.
Motion approved, seconded by Ernie, all in favor?
Aye.
Okay, thank you. Just as a note.
We don't know water.
Yeah. It's open to the public, however, no public comment will be accepted. It's just for the discussion meeting. We will start with item number two, an update from Director Mike, Assistant Director Mike.
Okay, Greg's not here because he has to do a conference call with Dan Asher, the Director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, regarding the wolf and the whole delisting issue. So hopefully he may be able to share some information on that when he gets done with that. It should take about half an hour. So in the meantime, I'm going to cover for him on the update. There's just a couple things he wanted me to cover. And we'll be brief today because we have a meeting next week where he can go in more depth on some of the issues that he wants to cover. But we do have this deal at 4 o'clock today where you can test fire or test drive several non-conventional weapons, let's say, muzzleloaders with multi-powered scopes and crossbows, and I think we have some muzzleloaders with single-powered scopes, so you can see what it's like. These issues have been coming up from the public on with requests for us to consider perhaps loosening up our restrictions on those types of weapons, so we wanted to give you all a chance to test drive and see what they're like. So we'll have that opportunity after we get done with the meeting here. We have our awards function tonight, our first annual stewardship awards that we're doing, mostly for the public, that Stacy has headed up and done a great job putting together. So looking forward to that. And we'll also be recognizing our board members who are leaving the board at that awards function tonight as well. So that's at the Radisson Hotel, right, Stacy?
Yes, 6 o'clock.
Okay. That's all he wanted me to cover, so unless there's any questions, I'll give it back to you guys.
Any questions? Okay, we'll go to item number three, John Schimmick. Update on the panel control.
Mr. Tillman. Again, this is another little short sweet thing too. I think I've been trying to keep everybody up to date on the coyote. I just gave you a little handout there. I'm generating this more or less every month anyway. I just ran these numbers. These are good uphill today, essentially. So 6,700 coyotes turned in, $336,000 worth of turning in animals. Most of the coyotes are actually taken from that West Desert Box Elder units in terms of where they're being harvested. I'm still working on better maps. We've got a lot of, you know, a few points in the middle, it's the Salt Lake, and you know, things some cleaning to do, so I didn't have a map ready for consumption quite yet, but I'm hoping to get that together soon. But based on the data that we have so far, I broke it down by region for you there too. Southern's definitely, most of the coyotes are coming out of there, southern, northern, central, just that east side. The targeted program is one that's had more developments in the last couple weeks. So I've got three contracts up and running, one in the Henrys, one in the Elk Ridge, and one in the Pavant. And the guidelines in terms of how we're gonna run these targeted into the future. I've been on this course of seeing what kind of money we have at the end of the fiscal year. Anything that we have will roll over into the next fiscal year, and then I know exactly what I have to put into targeted programs. So that's kind of why I've reasoned it through. So I'm hoping by July, the general plan is to put on the web, here's places where we haven't had a lot of coyote take, but where deer numbers are down. If you're interested,
sign up for these different locations and do sort of a bidding process, an informal kind of bidding process. That's the way I'm envisioning it now. We can see, you know, how it develops. And I'm very happy to take any input on that too, of course. After a week, if you go down to the graphs there, the coyotes per week, we had our big peak there, January, February, and it's really dropping off now. We just had, you know, 10 people in the last 2 weeks or so turn coyotes in. So that's slowing down. And if you look at that cumulative graph, you can see how it's flattening towards the end of the year there. We're approaching the end of the fiscal year. My guess is we're gonna have in program probably around 7,500 people or 7,500 coyotes turned in, something like that. In comparison, the average number taken by harvesters per year based on our fur bearer survey is 7,300, well, basically 7,400. So we're kind of right on line for that. And that's all I have.
So these numbers don't include fur harvesters?
Well, we'll try to get a handle on that in our survey to find out how many people that were out for fur also turned in their coyotes. So all I have now is an estimate of previous years of how many people had a fur bearer license harvested coyotes. And then hopefully this year I'll know how many people that turned in or that were fur harvesting also submitted for bounty.
John, as this progresses, are you going to look at the numbers of coyotes taken versus deer populations in these different regions to see if there's an influx of deer retainment and recruitment and so forth?
Exactly. That's the way I designed it. So we started to break it down numbers, and that's how I kind of broke down the units a little bit. They're not precise enough. They aren't clean enough for me to give you a unit by unit right now. But yes, I'm breaking it down by deer unit, number of coyotes taken, removed from that unit, and then we'll be able to match that up. And I'll do some correlations with the number of coyotes removed, what the Pondo ratio is, and there'll be some pretty extensive analyses we can do out of this. It's pretty interesting.
And right now, folks who want to begin this can just kind of go anywhere they want within state boundaries and participate. So as you see these numbers, are you going to try to steer people into other areas that maybe the take's not as much as you need it to be or would like it to be?
Right, and that's the goal of the way the targeted program is set up. One of the other reasons for why the targeted program isn't just off and running, I want to see where the coyotes are removed from first. I want to see what our deer populations look like, and then we can send those people to the right places at the right time. That's the way it's been thought through.
On the contracts that are left or about to be left, what's the hunting period for those?
For the ones that are going right now, they'll be done here at the end of the month.
No, I mean, if we're targeting protection of fawns,
right?
So is the contract open-ended or is it
the current
June to 30 June?
Yeah, it's through June. So the current contract's got up and running about because of concern about these particular units and having people in the right place, right time to go in and do some den work. So essentially, they started to do den work from now and through the end of June. And that's, calling and doing whatever else they can do on these units.
And are these contracts for this year?
They're off the running now. This fiscal year right now. Those three that are going.
So next year we're going to start.
You'll see a lot of
contracts much earlier.
Yes.
And they'll be May and June.
What we'll see them run through is if I can, I'll start them running in December through June. So.
Okay. What about the ADC tape this year?
I don't have those numbers from those guys yet.
Because they got an extra. They 250 down.
Well, they got 600 plus 250, so they got 850. Just from wildlife between our licenses, 600 or so from licenses and the other 250. But I haven't reported back. We're up and running now. I'm just now getting our predator management plans approved, and that's what we will use to get with Wildlife Services next year to target specific units. So it's a real big juggle right now, trying to have everybody not stacked up on each other.
So if I understand Bill's question, in a year or so, maybe you'll steer those people away from the desert box elder units, the West Desert ones?
The way it's written, I can't steer the general program any more than I already am, which is, it's really clear in that if you sign up for it, in the training for it, and in the map that's presented, is please try to focus on deer units. And it's interesting, if you're at the check-ins, you talk to the guys, their heart's all in the right place. Everyone that I talk to, they all say, oh, we're doing this for the deer. And a lot of people do call me up and say, where are the deer now? Where should I be going? And I'll try to head them towards that winter range and those kinds of places. But in terms of closing deserts, I don't have the ability to do that. It's the way it's written, it is statewide, any kind of.
However, if you could get the number of contracts that you wanted.
That's where we have the control.
And have, say, $400,000 worth of contracts, there'd only be $100,000 left for the public program, right?
Mm-hmm.
The open program. So you'd have 90% of the effort targeted.
Right.
And there'd only be 10% that is this random go out in the desert and shoot one.
And that could be an approach. I'm just worried about, frankly, about being able to, because the way it works for wildlife services, because then you're talking helicopters, expense, because, you know, and then, you know, their cost per coyote is $500 or something like that. Whereas, about guys hunting out of a truck, it's kind of hard to justify $600,000 or $100,000 or big payments to one of those guys. But I'm, you're bringing up points that's exactly what we're struggling with right now.
John, the take that's here, how does that compare to future years before this county was put in place?
That's what I mean. I think we're going to come in terms of, it's not a perfect comparison. But I do know from like previous papers and things, what bounties tend to do is you tend to end up paying people that are already out hunting anyway just to get a bounty. It generally doesn't attract gobs of new people. And I think it's particularly the case with coyotes because they're a lot harder, they're not easy to hunt, especially in bigger numbers, unless you know what you're doing. So my guess is, and I put those numbers for comparison, we're probably going to remove more or less the same number of coyotes we generally remove, plus, That's speculative, so don't take that too far. But based on the numbers of what we normally get reported as removed and what we're on track to remove, it's kind of falling into line that way.
On the rural unit where it's a study unit for coyote removal on the north end, I think right now, did we do a lot of aerial cutting there this week to make sure that study would fall in the way that it was supposed to, and what kind of numbers did you get off of?
That's worked directly with Wildlife Services, and I don't have that report in front of me.
So is Wildlife Services the only people that go in there with their chopper netters or any other?
It's being done with Wildlife Services.
Okay. It's not illegal for anybody else to do that.
But I was wondering if they had some other selective denning or whatever.
There are some issues using aircraft for wildlife. There are federal restrictions on that. They can get permits and get that done. And maybe that's one way we'll do our targeted program. And I'll work with Wildlife Services, and they generally are the guys the first go to in order to get people permits to do the aerial work.
Could you have that report for us as a handout next week?
The Wildlife Services or the Monroe, or which?
We just got Monroe.
Monroe, we can put some Monroe stuff together for you for certain. Yeah, I would think that you're already giving all of that, but I'll put some together for you.
John, just for perspective, there's only a half a dozen aerial gunning permits that are out there. I believe they're issued through Ag, aside from what Wildlife Services does. So there's only a handful of folks that are eligible to do that.
Right, and that's why I think it might be hard to target.
I've seen them, but that is why.
There are guys out there, but we'll look for them.
So we got a contract on the Pavant for $7,500. Is that for to achieve that money, does the contractor have to kill X number of coyotes?
No.
It's expend the effort, and we'll see what we get.
What I do is they have to document, they'll have hours in the field, the coyotes they get, the locations, dens,
So what I'm looking for, again, from an analytical point of view, is time spent, what I'd like to see catch per unit effort go down as they go. That is, they might see a lot of coyotes at first, but the important thing is not just to skim the easy ones at first, the important thing is to start to dig into the population. So what I do is I have them report a lot of what their effort is through time, and then report the coyotes that they take. So in a lot of ways, it's kind of like wildlife services. It's not a numbers game. I don't want to get the impact on the population confused with, you know, just sort of this raw amount of coyotes. And the other thing is, the reason you target places is to get places where people, you know, aren't going, or, you know, coyotes might be hard to get. A lot of our targeted things are going to be those places where coyotes are harder to get. So their catch per unit effort versus out in the West Desert is going to be, it's going to be a lot harder to get those coyotes.
Like on the hen race, that 10,000, is that one contract or multiple contracts?
That's one contract. All these are, each one's one contract. Right now it's coming in the way it was set up. Well, that's one contract. That one's a little complicated because the rule says that for someone to be eligible to participate in the targeted program, that they have to have turned in coyotes. And what happened down there is the guy that was lined up to do it hadn't participated in the targeted program, but there was, but he was working with two other guys. So I've got three guys working together for one guy, and they're doing it as a group of three, essentially. So I found one guy that was in the targeted program, so we're all following the rules and doing everything right, essentially.
You know, you're doing that, you're finding that you can do it with locals from those areas?
I think that's what's going to be the preferred approach, absolutely. These guys had done work already in that area last year, so it was kind of, they knew the lay of the land. Mm-hmm. With coyotes, they tend to be pretty predictable. If you know where they're coming every year, you can set traps in those places and you'll get them. So it makes sense to try to hire people that are familiar with those locations.
Any other questions? Thank you, John.
Sure. I'll put that report information for you.
Item number four, update on Crafty Point discussion. Lindy?
All right. So I'm here to update you guys from last work session to talk about the reference point system with our new information from the current big game application. So I kind of, you guys all, kind of my PowerPoint, since we're not doing PowerPoint, just printed out for you guys so you guys can look at it. It's also in your drop boxes, so you guys can always have it. The first one, it's kind of a rough general how the draw works again. We start with lifetime permits, then we go to the dedicated hunter applications, then the youth 18 and under, then that's when we evaluate the rest of the applications. And then I also put the graph in there just to make sure that we understand that it goes sideways, so one applicant's all five choices are looked at first before we move to the next applicant. So that's how the sequence works right now for our general season draws. The next one, I put in the 2012 data and then also with the 2013 data so we can compare the difference. As you can see, in 2012, we had 100,854 applications. This year, we did increase, we went to 106,308. So we increased about 6,000 applications. Last year, a little over 65,000 people drew their first choice. This year, a little over 64,000 people drew their first choice. So when you look at the percent, it's 65 versus 61% people. And then last year, 4,500 people drew their second choice. This year, around 5,300 people drew their second choice. In 2012, around 1,700 people drew their third, and actually around 1,700 people drew their third. That one still stayed around 2%. And then on the fourth choice, 789 drew their fourth for 2012, and in 2013, 774 people drew their fourth. And then for the fifth in 2012, it was 484 people. And this year, there's only 321 people that drew their fifth choice. And of course, we did have more people that were unsuccessful this year, just because we did cut some tags this year. And we also had more applications. So there was 31,000 people that were unsuccessful versus 25,000 last year.
That could also, though, couldn't that be because they didn't apply for as many choices?
It could be.
They cherry-picked where they were applying.
And that could be a possibility, too. But, you know, for the most part, yeah, we're looking at, you know, everyone that drew a choice, 1 through 5, and then someone that did not receive a deer tag did not draw, and that's the 31,000.
Why did a lower percentage draw their first choice?
This year? I can't tell for sure, but it looks like the second choice percentage did go up by just a titch.
Part of that was more applications.
But the main reason why, to me, is because, you know, our applications did go up, you know, 6,000. So there were more people picking for the first choice, and there were, you know, those prime units, the tags were cut. So they probably didn't get the choice that they wanted. And so they only got one choice, or maybe they did put a second choice in. That data I don't have, just because everything is still being finalized through the draw. Because everything's not finalized till Friday, unfortunately.
Statistically, it's probably
needed
more applicants and less permits.
That's kind of what we're thinking. This kind of breaks it down a little bit more on the next page. This kind of shows the people that earned a point and also drew a permit. So back in 2012, last year, not that far away, 7,500 people drew a tag and also earned a point. This year we had 8,225 that drew a tag and earned a point that had two or more in their second through fifth choice. But out of those, if you look at the 8,225, only 2,117 had a point or more. So, you know, if you look at it, that's only 1.9% of the applicants that actually had a point that drew a second choice or higher, had a point or more that drew their second choice. And back in 2012, 1,300 applicants had a point or more when they drew. And then, of course, we do have people that just purchase a preference point. Last year, we had around 8,200 people that purchased, and this year it was 8,800 people that purchased a point. People buy those just because maybe they can't go hunting this year, or you know, some obligation came up where they want a point so they can still draw next year. So I was unable to get some data from 2012, just because our contractor was unable to pull a fast for us, but I did get some from 2013. This kind of breaks down that 8,225. So you look at the first five rows. The first column talked about that were not successful for the first choice that had 0 points was 6,100 people. So they had 0 points and they were not successful. The second line talks about they had 1 point and there's 1,700 people that had 1 point that were not successful for their first but drew either the second through fifth. And then as you keep looking at 2 points, there was 267 people that drew. Some that had 3 points, there was only 64 people that drew. 4 points, there was only 7 people that drew their second through fifth choice. And after that, they had 5 points more, they did draw their first choice. That's why it only goes to 4. And then this breaks down the remaining of the permits that they were successful for their first choice and how many points they had. So 39,000, roughly, had 0 points and they drew their first choice. There was 21,200 people that drew their first choice that had 1 point. 441 people drew with 3 points. And it's, you know, each point goes down someone finally put in that had 13 points, finally drew their tag. They finally realized that it's not limited entry. And we're assuming that's non-resident. Like I said, I don't have the data of who they are. or anything like that, but we're assuming it was probably a non-resident because looking at last year's data, that's who had 13 points. So based on our data that we have done for the last 2 years, it doesn't show that there's a significant number of applicants that are drawing desirable units and then accruing points to draw on more desirable units next year. So based on the 2 years of data, we recommend to leave the general season permits point system as it currently is. And that's the data that I have. The rest of this is kind of showing you, I broke it down for all 90 units. I started with the HUT number, 1500, and went down to 1589. Put down for 2012 is the first line, 2013 is the second line. It talks about what HUT number it was, where it was ranked, and how we ranked them was based on number of applicants that put in for that unit. That's how we based how popular it was by how many people actually wanted that HUT, even if they didn't draw or did not draw. And then we put how many applicants were put in for that and how many were successful and the percentage. And we also did it for the second choice. And that's the next like 8 pages because I broke down through every single one. And as you look through it, the ranking didn't change by much. The number one unit still is Central Mountains Manti, San Rafael, for 2 years now. The number two unit, the Wasatch Vinicum Kern Creek is the still number two for both years. The top 10 didn't change by much. The top 10 are the same as last year, but some of them swapped places. So, if you have any questions, I'd love to answer them.
Okay, we have a meeting next week and we'll have the questions.
What was that?
I said, be to the meeting next week and we'll have...
No, I heard you. I love presenting. It's my favorite thing ever.
That's a lot of detail. That's good.
That is very good.
Oh, thank you. Like I said, we can definitely get more information, especially next week when everything is finalized. I can pull a lot more data from our contractor. So
I've got a comment, not a question at this point. This will be the last time I have the opportunity to address this, so it's going to be up to the five members that remain to make a decision on this with two new people down the road. I understand your recommendation based upon the concept that it's statistically not a problem.
Uh-huh.
The total number of applications we have and the very small number of people that have preference points and potential to abuse. However, personally, I could get upset about this as much as I got upset when we have people that were accumulating preference points and selling them on eBay to somebody
bonus
else.
Points. To those are the bonus points.
Yeah. That's right. That was bonus points. And I would do anything I could to prevent that kind of abuse and that kind of gaming the system and disservice to our other sportsmen. So I did talk with Kenny earlier today.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I think what I'd like to look at, if I was going to be looking at anything, which I won't, is I'd like to look at those people that were not successful for their first choice, the seven that have four bonus points,
yeah, but I put a request
points,
in.
The 64 that have three,
yeah.
And see, what did they put down for their second choice,
yeah.
And did they get it?
And I put that request in for you to get, and I did next week to get it, so.
Okay.
So I did talk to him about
that. So I'd like to see, because I can think of a way of fixing this without having to dump the whole system, which I would not want to do. The way to fix it is if we got one or two units that are prompting that kind of abuse, might be just to say, this is how the preference points system works. except on these two units. And on these two units, it works differently, and the board could do that. Now, there may be some drawbacks on that. I haven't had the time to think through pluses and minuses, and we need you folks to tell us what the pluses and minuses would be. But if we've got somebody that's gaming the system, screwing other people, pardon me, I'd like to shut it down.
And I'll, like I said, I'll get that data, and then when I do get it, I'll let you know, so we can kind of look at those units that they were, what their first choice was, and what they actually drew out for, see what, if they're the same units, or if they're across the whole board. It'd be nice to know, for sure.
Other questions? Okay, thank you, Lou.
Thank you.
Next, item number five, Stacy. Multiple-year guidebooks.
All right, at the last board meeting, Ernie asked if we do an update on where we were at with the multi-year guidebook. So the PowerPoint's over on the corner, but it's also in your Dropbox, if you want to have it that way. Just a reminder, we went to multi-year guidebooks for a couple of reasons. It was to allow us to have consistent regulations for a set period of time. We could coincide them with the implementation of management plans. It would reduce the cost of rack and board meetings by only sending our employees out every 1 to 3 years instead of every year. And then it allowed us to provide consistency in data collection. So the guidebooks that have already gone multi-year, we have Ferber, Cougar, Bear, Upland, and Turkey have all gone to a 3-year cycle. They've all completed 1 3-year cycle, and we're going to keep them on 3-year cycles. Falconry and CIP went to 5-year, and we're going to keep those on 5-year cycles. Now the guidebooks we haven't moved over. The Big Game application guidebook and the Atlas application stay yearly. That's just your hunt tables and the information that's needed for a short period of time. The Big Game field regulations. Here's the issue with that one. Our deer plan is up for renew in 2014. The elk plan comes up in 2015. The Big Game section is willing to try a 3-year guidebook in 2015 once the deer and the elk management plans have been set. So you may see that one come out in 2015 as a 3-year test. Fishing is willing to try a 2-year guidebook. However, they would like to wait until next spring to send it out as an informational to the anglers and get some feedback that way. So they would start a 2-year cycle in 2015 as well. And then waterfowl is set by the feds, so that one is going to stay a single year. So there you have it in a nutshell.
Why fishing? What's their hang up?
They're kind of scared of this whole rack board process. They only go to one rack board meeting a year. So everything seems to be a little bit of a step-by-step process. They want to run it out through their informational, and they don't feel like they have enough time to get that ready for this next month when they send out the informational for this year. So they want to float it by their biologist and then take it out next spring, and then it would be the November recommendations next year.
So
they're just cautious.
If they go to that 2-year guidebook, will they have the rack meeting in between those 2 years?
No. They would set the regulations for 2 years.
So there'd be no informational items or anything then?
Right.
I like multiple year guidebooks on some things, but I think we've lost a little bit of our rack attendance and some of our other things that happen in those off years. And like on the Cougar one, we visited that a couple times because of different things, different scenarios the last couple of years. But that's just a comment on my part. They're good in some ways, and there's also an offset in some others.
No reason why they couldn't do the informational 1 year and do the 2-year or 3-year proclamations next year.
No, there's no reason why they couldn't do it sooner than that. They would just choose to enter a little more cautiously.
If I could address the board, could provide some information to that. The aquatic section is going through a series of open houses in each of the regions to gather public input on various waters around the state. They would like to gather that information before it goes to the RAC so they can have better public input to provide to the RAC when they go through the process.
Are you privy to how those have turned out so far?
So far, I think they've been very good. Participation has been very high. Anglers have, at least the feedback that I've gotten from the Anglers Coalition and some of the others, that it's been very positive.
So the meeting's been fairly well attended?
Yes.
I was wondering, I missed the one in Salinas.
There is a link on our website, too, for a survey that the aquatic section is doing right now with regard to some proposed regulations. They're looking for public input through that as well.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you, Stacy. Agenda item number 6. Update on the trip to Mason Robbins.
Good afternoon. Give you a quick update on turkey summit that we had. We had it a month ago on April 25th. We held it in Springville, the Central Region office. We had 37 folks that attended that meeting, all five of the DWR regions. The director's office was there. National Wild Turkey Federation, we had great attendance from them. We had representatives from the national level, the state level, and the local chapter level. We also had Sportsmen for Wildlife there in attendance, several of their members, and a representative from the Utah Turkey and Wildlife Foundation. And Ernie was also in attendance as, I guess, a dual role with the board and the Turkey Foundation. We had Director Sheehan was in attendance and gave some opening remarks. Talked very highly of the success story of turkeys here in the state of Utah. But most of the meeting was towards group discussion to allow folks to have the opportunity to talk. It was a half day meeting, but we felt like everyone had the opportunity to express their interest and things that are working and some of the concerns that they might have. Just to touch on a couple of the items that were brought up a couple of times. Keep translocating turkeys within the state, fill in the habitat gaps. There's still places in the state, quite a few places that we feel we can have wild turkeys. And we have good sources of turkeys now, both within the state and out of state. There's some opportunity as well. Winter habitat work, specifically winter feeding projects to make sure that turkeys have food to sustain them through the winter. The winter feeding policy was brought up several times. There's, I guess, differing views on how feeding should take place for turkeys. Just to inform you, we do actually have an upland game feeding policy that's in place. Youth hunting opportunity was brought up on several occasions, increasing that opportunity. Viewing turkey hunting is a great gateway into big game hunting just because of the similarities in style and that sort of thing. And then the management plan, there's a current management plan for turkeys here in the state. It was written in 2000. So one of the several folks commented that they'd like to see a revision of that management plan. Several folks commented on they really liked the current hunt structure that we have in place with the limited entry hunt and then an over-the-counter with youth opportunity in both of those. One person I think used the word perfect, which I thought was great, you know. So a lot of positive comments about the hunt structure we have currently. Another reoccurring theme was they want turkeys to be viewed as a positive thing for the state and a real success story. They don't want turkeys to be viewed as a nuisance species, which this last legislative session there was a little bit of talk of that. And most of these folks want to try and do everything we can to keep a positive light on wild turkeys. After that, I gave a presentation on the current hunt structure, and we've got three triggers when we went over the counter to kind of track how we were doing. Those three triggers were look at crowding, hunter satisfaction, and percent harvest success. So we've got 3 years of data on that I presented, and of those three triggers, we've been well within the criteria on all three of them, with one exception. The very first year we went over the counter, the hunt success actually was at 20%, which was the level we set that bar at. But it went up, and it's been above that ever since. And the main reason for that first year,
is you had a lot of folks that went out and bought a turkey tag because it was their first opportunity to just go get one over the counter. And they found out that turkeys are smart when you hunt them, and they're tough to get. But we've seen an increase in hunt success since then. One of the interesting things, just kind of for your information, was on the crowding index, the over-the-counter hunt had a lower crowding index than the limited entry. So people felt less crowded with the over-the-counter. And a lot of that's the perception going into that. You know, limited entry guys probably think they're going to have the mountain to themselves. So if they see one other hunter, you know, they have concerns or they felt crowded. Where over-the-counter guys think they're going to be a guy behind every tree. And when they don't see that, they're pretty happy about it. So that's just kind of an interesting fact. We felt like everyone had the opportunity to voice their opinion, including our personnel, DWR folks. And we came up with a next step. And basically the next step is to revise the current turkey management plan. And we feel like we can cover a lot of those big topics that were brought up, you know, winter feeding, winter habitat, and that sort of thing, with the revision of that plan. And so that's the next step. DWR is going to come up with a sequence, lay out a sequence of events on how we see that revision taking place. And so basically that's where we left it, and we'll move forward moving here into the future. Thanks.
The hunt structure with the youth, was there any talk about giving them some more extended days?
There was. One of the things that was brought up is on the limited entry, so 15% of the permits are held for youth. And one of the conversations that was had was, if those youth on the limited entry are not successful in harvesting a bird, could they then hunt the youth weekend and the over-the-counter season? And the group felt like that would be a positive thing. There was a little bit of concern for allowing the general hunter, not youth, to be able to do that, but they were very receptive to the youth being able to have that opportunity.
So how many days do they have now?
Well, it depends. The limited entry, for the 15%, they have the entire limited entry season. Then if the kids want to go over the counter, they have a weekend prior to, so it's in between the limited entry.
So they only have a couple days there.
Where they're just hunting by themselves, yes. And then they can hunt the rest of the over the counter.
And this just a little discussion. Is there a way that you can move the limited entry startup day 2 or 3 days earlier without causing a huge hunter success and give the youth maybe 5 days?
No. We could look at that. It's a pretty fine line. You want to make sure that most of the hens get bred, and that occurs usually early April. And so that's why we have the hunt date when it is. And we don't want to impact the female nesting. But it's something I think we could look at. And seeing, you know, a couple days here and there might not matter. Probably depends on the spring of that particular year. But it's something we can look at.
So on your hunter success, you mentioned the 20% the first year. What are they now?
Usually right around anywhere from 25% to 30%. And a lot of that, I personally, I think that might increase a little bit as you get more experienced hunters. You know, turkey hunting is still new in the state, and they're tough animals to hunt. So I think you'll get a little bit of education. People will become better hunters. So I think we'll probably be right around 30%.
They're also increasing the number of hunters.
We saw a pretty good spike when it went over the counter, and then we're starting to see kind of a tailing off as people either try it and don't like it or try it and it's harder than they thought, that kind of thing.
Your over the counter sales, majority of those people hunt 50 miles within their home, or do they travel close? Or do you have that info?
I don't have that info. I imagine a lot of them are hunting pretty close to home, but there's quite a bit of interest in the southern part of the state. It's in the, but there's also more turkey down there. But
there's more to do.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't have the exact figures for that.
The turkeys that we have areas that you still like to see them get turkeys. As you're looking at those areas and thinking about stocking programs,
Do you look at where those birds are likely going to spend the winter after they've been put out there so that you, you know, don't have as many complaints that we were getting in some situations with the winter turkeys being, you know, in big numbers in people's yards and things like that?
Yeah, we have in the past, but I think we probably more so now. You know, the northern region where we've had some issues with turkeys being in people's yards and that sort of thing, that region probably might be saturated now. We'll probably look at moving some of those birds to other parts of the state, but that is definitely.
And do you have any kind of like this feeding program you mentioned? Can you put that in areas where you have this, you know, big population of turkeys to try to keep them from wandering off of where you'd like to keep them?
Yeah, so our turkey feeding policy basically gives us the options. We don't want it to be a long-term sustainability thing, but we can use it in the short term to help us manage turkeys in a way that's probably in their best interest as well as the local folks.
Well, it was an excellent meeting. There was a bunch of people in this room that were there, and there was a lot of interest, a lot of different opinions, and a lot of commonality of opinions. One reason for the drop-off in the general season permits might be the turkey die-off down in the southeast region in particular. I don't have any statistics to back that up, but we had some pretty heavy winter losses a couple of years ago. That may have impacted the number of people who were going to get a ticket or a permit to go. Could I ask Mike if he could shoot from the hip a little bit on some of the challenges you've got this coming year in trying to implement perhaps implement the stuff the legislature and things that might be coming to the board one way or another?
Yeah, I mean, Scott can jump in or Justin can jump in too, but it's certainly going to cause us to be way more proactive and jump on top of things because we're going to be required to respond to some of these issues by statute now. So it's going to increase workload. And we're going to have and the good thing about this meeting is we know there are a cadre of volunteers out there that will help us, but we're going to have those lined up and ready to go when we start foreseeing some issues like we did in Mendon last year. We may have to respond quickly and get volunteer help to help us do that, but it is going to be an increase in workload. But we'll gear up and be ready to do it because, as Jason says, we want to make sure the turkey not viewed as a nuisance but as a positive for the state, so we'll be very responsive to that.
Have any transplants planned for that area right now?
They took them all last year. He believed a few that are left up there now.
They took them all last year. We took a bunch last year. Statewide, almost 800 turkeys we moved last year. A good chunk of those were out of the northern region. So about 12.
We're down to bare bones. Probably ought to transplant some back.
Well, the thing is, too, is we have identified a list of places we can put birds if we do run into nuisance problems and we have to move them. So we have places they can go, and if we have volunteers to help us move them, it'll be good.
There's one other thing the board may be needing to do short notice next year, and that would be a fall hunt with specified duration, specified location. But that could easily prompt emergency meetings, I think.
Yeah.
Or electronic meetings.
The plan right now, because we are on a three-year guidebook, next April will be the RAC with the main board. So we're hoping to implement a fall hunt strategy through that process, so it all will be within that upland game and turkey guidebook.
Will a fall hunt be either sex?
Most likely, yeah. We haven't worked out the details, but most likely.
Would it be for next fall of 2014?
Correct.
When do you need to have the first problem?
What was it? 2014? Or 2013?
Well, 2013 would require emergency board meeting and implementation, and we're hoping that we can stay on top of issues and get another another year under our belt and then bring it to the table when we regularly bring the turkey guidebook to the, and the proclamation to the board.
So the...
Is that right, Jason?
What we're planning to do is have a depredation hunt option for this coming fall.
Okay.
And then in fall of 2014, have a guidebook type hunt that would take place that people could either go purchase the license or some kind of a draw system. But we haven't worked out the
Is there anybody here that would know the background of why we went away from the fall hunt that you used to have?
Well, with fall hunts, you can have population impacts. Mm-hmm. And so when we were trying to grow our turkey population, it was thought that a spring hunt would be a better hunt strategy as we're trying to grow populations within the state. And so to implement a new fall hunt, most of them are in either sex. So we would target these in areas where we have nuisance problems.
Yeah.
To try and help make the turkeys more wild and help keep that population in control.
So the people, and there's some all over the state that like turkeys on there, and they feed them to create a large population. Was there any talk of how to deal with those, or how to solve that problem so they're not so?
There's been a lot of talk about that very thing.
We offer cracked corn for them.
ask the mayors of all municipalities to pass
so
codes.
So is there any penalties or anything for those people doing that now? Or
if they're bird lovers, why would you want to penalize them?
So education? Would that be the target there then?
Yep, absolutely.
Can I ask, Justin, did Mendon consider a closure for bird feeding, or are they an ordinance?
You know, we talked a little bit about it in Mendon, but I don't know that it ever went anywhere. Now, for urban deer, the town of Newton did pass a
no feeding
ordinance. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So we've been asking the municipalities that are having the issues to consider that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Water policy, Blair.
All right. So we just barely included this water policy on yesterday afternoon, so a lot of my notes are not nearly as in depth as they could have been. We had probably 10 or 15 poster board size pages of notes. So I just tried to condense it into some of the main bullet points, but overall format was similar to what was done with the Turkey Summit. Had most of the major groups there, ducks in there with a Delta waterfowl, Beach Waterfowl Association, that minded. Several guys were there, unloaders, and shrimp invitation from the clubs as well. We also had a fair number of sportsmen, so it was really a good group to try to facilitate a discussion and get some information back from them. Our overall agenda for the meeting, we had two different discussion topics. First, we talked about our current management, what we're doing, and what we can improve upon. We had a second discussion, which focused primarily on ways we can increase waterfowl hunters throughout the state. It's become one of our main priorities in the waterfowl program to try to increase the number of people we have participating in waterfowl hunting. We've gone from the mid-70s, about 50,000 people, down to about 17,000 last year. So it's definitely been a decline, and one of the things we want to try to address and get people's feedback on. The other half of our meeting we used to address some of the major topics going on in the waterfowl program right now, such as banding, dragon mites, urban geese, things like that. Some of the main topics that came out of it, the discussion with the current and future management. Phragmites, which is always an issue. A lot of people are just concerned about the spread of phragmites, primarily along the Great Salt Lake. It's closing off habitat out in the lake. A lot of the airboaters are seeing fewer and fewer spots they can hunt. It's also creating some access challenges as those stands get dense. I mean, to walk through them takes quite a bit of effort. You can rip your waders and dogs get injuries. So it's really caused some issues with access. Overall, access throughout Utah, I think we tried to open people's eyes. Lynn Zubek gave a really good presentation on some of the opportunities throughout Utah and the southern part of the state. we have a lot of waterfowl management areas out there that most people aren't really utilizing. So some discussion came up about providing better information about those. We can also address that through our walking access program. There's a lot of areas out there that we could probably get opened up to sportsmen, so sportsmen are concerned about access throughout Utah. More information about our WMAs. A lot of people just want to get more feedback on where they are. Some people just need to know where parking areas are, where they can go to have a good pass shoot or a good decoy shoot. So we got some feedback that way. Some feedback about social media. A lot of people, especially the our target audience, the 18 to 30 year olds, are using Facebook and Twitter. And so there was some discussion on that. Particularly Rich Hampson is all stoked about getting a Facebook page for Farmington Bay, so that was an interesting discussion. We talked about just increasing opportunities for women and non-traditional hunting groups. We have more and more minorities coming to the state all the time, and so women, there's a lot of opportunities for those groups who aren't necessarily participating in waterfowl hunting right now. Some of the feedback from our discussion on increasing waterfowl hunters. Right now, there's really not much of an emphasis on our hunter ed program to train people to use shotguns. So that we can definitely make some progress there in working to associate shotguns with hunter ed and helping people to become more familiar with that firearm so they can take it out to go and hunt upland game birds and waterfowl. We talked a lot about the roles of mentors. Currently, a lot of our options we have, like the youth day, they focus primarily on one opportunity for someone new to go out and hunt, and then there aren't additional opportunities for them. And then it's not done with someone who can take them out consistently. And so we talked a lot about pairing those people with mentors and having, you know, individuals that can take people out multiple times. And after multiple experiences, hopefully they'll gain a stronger desire to go out in the future. We talked about some workshops that could be done to help recruit people, just to train them on how to use duck calls and decoys and things like that. One of the big things that came out of it was actually eating the ducks. I know among most waterfowl hunters, you tell them you want duck hunting, and their first question is, what'd you do with the ducks? Did you eat them? Because most people aren't doing that. But, you know, in actuality, waterfowl are excellent to eat. It's just a matter of learning how to prepare them. So we could probably do a lot more training our hunters how to use the game that they're taking and how they could actually make it into a pretty good meal. One other really good idea that came from the group is our youth fairs. We currently do a really big waterfowl youth fair each year at Farmington Bay. It usually happens just before our waterfowl hunt. We haven't done them in any other parts of the state, so there was a lot of support from some of the user groups like Ducks Unlimited and Delta Waterfowl and such that would like to try to expand those in other parts of the state, say in Richfield or Delta or Cedar City or, you know, anywhere where we don't have a big group of waterfowl hunters, but there are opportunities for them. So that's something that came out of that group as well. So how we can really tie all that together, I mean, there's a lot of things that we can do. We're definitely going to increase our Phragmites efforts. We've been looking at burns as a way to remove the residual Phragmites stands after we spray them. We usually get pretty good kill by spraying with herbicide, but if we don't remove that top layer that has grown that year, then nothing new can grow up in those stands just because they're so thick and dense. So we've used fire as a tool to try to remove that stem, but we can't do that in the majority of the counties along the Wasatch Front just because of burn restrictions. And so we've looked at additional ways to do that. We're starting to use cattle to open up areas again. We're also looking at trying to get more into getting people to actually come out and do that using contractors. We've tried to do it in-house up until now, and it's just a huge task to go out there and mow for several months just to remove these stands. So there's some challenging things there, but we can definitely work on them. Improving pony hunting outside the Great Salt Lake, that's pretty simple. All you just do is create some maps and start advertising those, get people using some of our other areas. Working to improve the hunter ed program and involving shotguns, again, probably something we just need to work with some of our other sections with and try to increase opportunities for shotgun shooting in hunter ed. We have been working on the Hunter Ed Plus program and transitioning that into the waterfowl program. Again, that's something that is on our radar and we're working on. We just need to really recruit more mentors. There's a lot of desire for people to help in that regard. It's just a matter of organizing them. So we'll be doing that. Hopefully have a group of mentors ready for this fall to take, start taking kids out going through the 100 plus program. actually, just Facebook. I got an email from Rich already today. He's setting up his Facebook page, so we may try to that avenue to advertise and try to recruit more people. So,
overall, so did you like him?
What's that?
Did you like him?
I haven't yet. I haven't seen the official page, but I will since I do. And that summarizes our summit that we had yesterday.
That was the first time foul-minded showed up in a division thing that I know of. Could you talk a little bit? It's a new conservation group to me, yeah. Beyond one previous experience. National, local, how many chapters? Are they going to expand?
Yeah, I mean, I think last year or so is really when they've started. It's a group of guys who have been involved with some of the bigger organizations like Ducks Unlimited and Delta Waterfowl. They've had bad experiences with those groups just because a lot of that money doesn't stay right here in Utah. It's going off for other projects and overheads for those groups. So this is just a group of guys who want to raise a lot of money and really just give it back to the wildlife in Utah. They've had plans right now to restore a dike out of Farmington Bay, which will help us to reduce phragmites as well as provide more opportunities for hunters out there. They'd also like to work in the upland game side of things. They're working, I think, with the Chucker Foundation to do some guzzlers.
They threw some money to the Chucker Foundation to help put in some guzzlers this year.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, their concept is just to try to raise money and give it back, and they've been really successful. This last banquet, I think they made about $30,000+ after all, you know, the prizes and meal costs. I think they still netted over $10,000, which they gave some of that back to us in the meeting yesterday. And I see them continuing to be really successful. There's a lot of guys out there that would like to participate in stuff like that that knows that the money will stay here. So I see them being really successful and growing in the future.
Any other questions?
That was a very good meeting yesterday. Like you said, all the major stakeholders were there. And the Fish and Wildlife Service from Bear River Refuge were there, and so it was a real good give and take throughout the day.
So about the guidebook here, when does your waterfowl hunt start this year approximately?
It's October 5th. It's usually the first weekend in October. And then we should have another 107-day season, I would assume, which will take us to about the middle of January.
It usually starts right after all the cinnamon teal leave the state.
Yeah.
Precisely.
Is that your favorite?
Just like the morning left.
Yeah.
September 1, 30.
So what kind of representation did you have from like throughout the state? Or was it mainly up in the northern area?
Yeah, for the most part it was guys along the Wasatch Front. We had some from Cache Valley. We had our biologists from the other parts of the state, like the guides or the region manages Clear Lake, so they were there. Lynn Zubek was there, Amy Vanderbord from the northeastern region. We really reached out to most of the waterfowlers around the state. I know Paul Niemeyer was hoping to make it, but there were some conflicts with just traveling. A lot of the guys that were locally here could come a lot more easily than most.
So on your waterfowl affairs that you talked about, is that something that's going to kind of be handled in-house, or looking for groups to take care of that?
It's been something that we've supported in the past, but it's primarily been on the backs of the different waterfowl groups in the state. Right now, Utah Waterfowl Association hosts it. Delta's been a big player in the past and still are. Ducks Unlimited are as well. I know Ducks Unlimited has been starting chapters around the state. They've got one in Cedar City. They have one in Delta. They have one that just started up in Price. And so I would assume, for the most part, that's still going to be
very active. They have a very active one in Richmond. That's why I was wondering.
Yeah, they do down there.
It's one of the, I think it has more attendees than any of the banquets that they hold out there.
Yeah. So I would assume it's primarily going in the backs of them. And they're really anxious to try to build their reputation in the state as well as recruit more people to be part of the organization.
So do you have the name of the DU state guy?
I do. It's Joe Trendilio. He's from Tooele. I could get you his contact information.
Okay. I could probably get it online.
Okay. Yeah, it is on their webpage.
Joe.
Yep. It's T-U-R-I-G-I-O or something. Yeah.
Nothing else? Thank you, Jared. You got a recipe online for how to cook them, right?
We do. There's a recipe that Tom Aldridge has. I think there's a picture of him with the grill and a giant fireball coming up. So
cool.
It's a cook for it.
Guess what, Mr. Chairman?
What's that?
I got my 100 unsuccessful emails now.
Unsuccessful?
So all of you should probably be getting it too. Unsuccessful.
Mine worked.
I haven't checked. Okay. Update on actions taken by the CWMU, Scott McFarland.
Thank you. I was just going to present some informational items on the actions of the CWMU committee that were taken this year. The CWMU committee met in February, and it was to address three complaints, and that's for 2012 season. For the 2011 season, there were no complaints. Boyd did his job very, very well. And there were some actions that were done in the 2010 season that probably need to be addressed today too. They're just informational. And as I said, there's three complaints that were heard by the CWMU committee. One was on the Durst Mountain CWMU. And I just probably should preface this and say that most of the complaints that are against the CWMUs are communication problems, and that's something we continually work on. But generally, the CWMUs have been doing a pretty good job on their treatment of the public hunters, and it has been improving. I guess Boyd's really cracked the whip on these guys for the last 4 or 5 years, so it has been improving. The CWMU Advisory Committee didn't recommend the board take any action. They recommended probationary status just for the division to monitor the actions of the CWMU and make sure that there are no further complaints dealing with the same thing that were complained on in the meeting. So the first one was on Durst Mountain. They had a complaint, and this was strictly about lack of communication between the public hunter. It was a public cow elk hunter and the CWMU. He just felt that he called and called, could never get a response back from the CWMU. It got towards the end of the season, and he didn't, the hunter felt like he didn't get a fair shake out of it. The day that he did, he was allowed to go in to hunt. He got snowed out, and then the next day he just had a half day to hunt. And so he didn't feel like he got quite a fair shake. The CWMU tried to call him back and schedule additional days for him, but I guess he was mad enough he didn't answer the call. So. And what the CWMU committee recommended on that was that he have a letter placed in his file just saying that he needed to improve the communication. And so they came up with a plan that basically they're going to try and create a website and communicate through email to better communicate with the hunters. It's not that they didn't want the elk harvested, they just said they were just very busy and needed to change the way that they corresponded with the hunters. So that was the action that was recommended to be taken on Durst Mountain. The second one is Cedar Canyon. This was dealing with a bull moose permit that was turned in. And kind of in a nutshell, the person that drew the permit had a friend that worked on the ranch on the CWMU that his permit was for. And this person got kicked off the ranch and didn't feel like he could get a fair shake at a hunt. So he turned in his permit, his once in a lifetime permit. And one of his beefs was, he was out $400 because when he turned his permit back in, it was past the date that he could get a refund. And it was resolved. The CWMU operator said, if I just write you a check, would that be okay? And the advisory committee says, if you guys can settle this out in the hall, that's fine. And they did. So that one was basically dropped. And the next one was the Broadmouth CWMU. And this was another lack of communication. Well, one of the things was a lack of communication. The hunter, this was one that was from the 2011 season, so basically it was a two-year-old complaint. He wasn't advised of the complaint process, and so we took it a year after that. And so Broadmouth CWMU, the committee well, the complaint was that he was never sent any information on how and when or where to hunt. He finally got a hold of the CWMU operator, and after he was notified, the CWMU operator advised him to do something illegal, which meant take his four-wheeler around a lock gate that was closed by the county, basically an illegal action. So the committee recommended that he be put on probation, no action taken, but monitored for the remaining 2 years of the application period of their COR, so that they would, in any similar type of complaints, they recommend action to the Wildlife Board, or recommend an action to be taken to the Wildlife Board. So, also, their satisfaction index on the broadmouth CWMU is consistently leaving low, and so they asked that they would, the CWMU would work on bringing that satisfaction index up on the antlerless elk hunt, not on their buck and bull hunt. So, and from 2010, from that meeting, there were four CWMUs that were put on probation. All of these, there was the Mini Mod CWMU, the Emma Park CWMU, the State Corner CWMU, and the Hardscrabble CWMU. And the first three, the Mini Mod and Emma Park and State Corner, all met the terms of their probation. One of those was a posting problem on the Mini Mod. They provided evidence that they had properly posted and had kept proper posting on the CWMU after they're put on probation. So the CWMU advisory committee were all in favor of taking them off of their probationary period. Emma Park, it was a communications problem also. They provided documentation how they were going to correct their communication problems with them. They implemented an orientation meeting with the hunters and several steps that they said that they would do. They didn't meet the requirements of their probation, so the committee recommended they be taken off also. And State Corner was basically the same thing. All in favor of communication problems again, taking them off their probationary period. The last one was the Hardscrabble. The division's continuing to monitor the Hardscrabble CWMU for compliance. One of the complaints on Hardscrabble was that all of the private hunters were on their antlerless elk hunts. All the private elk hunters were harvesting elk, but none of the public hunters were. And since that has changed. And in fact, last year when the Hardscrabble changed their application where they don't have any private permits, they're just going to take care of all the public hunters on there. But we're continuing to monitor those until 2014. 14 is when they're up due again. So,
yeah, Morgan.
Yeah, Morgan County. Hardscrabble's in Morgan. So basically, the CWMUs, that's not all that's just the complaints that come to the CWMU committee. There's more complaints, but what we try and do is make sure that they are resolved so they don't have to go to the committee, and that's usually the best way to do it. So.
Are they just complaints from the public?
Yes. Occasionally we have a complaint from a paying hunter, but that's very, very rare. But these are usually they have to do with the public, the treatment of the public by the CWMU. Yes.
The second one you talked about, the $400 exchange.
Yes.
That gentleman wouldn't have done that, would he?
If he would have turned his permit in prior to when the season, I believe it's in 30 days prior to the season.
The CWMU that gave him his money back?
They didn't have to. They just said if it'll resolve it. He says it doesn't matter to them. Can we resolve it in the hall? We'll just pay you for the permit. That's the way they wanted to resolve it.
And so that's good. That's something he wouldn't have had to do.
No, he absolutely did not have to do that. So they just went home and came back and said it's been taken care of. Thank you. So, and that's what the committee has accepted.
How many is on that committee?
There's 8 people on the committee.
So was Wade the president?
No, actually, there's nine people, including the wildlife section chief. The chief is the chairman of the committee. He's a non-voting member, but he's the one that chairs the committee, and there's eight voting people on it. There's,
and are they operators?
No, there's two people represented from the CWMU. There's two sportsman representatives. There's an elected official. There's somebody from the RAC. And then there's an at-large. I can tell you who they are, but if you're interested, real quick. I should have him committed to memory here, but Greg Wally is the at-large. He's from the Central Region. Cal Keach is the sportsman. Matt Brimhall is sportsman representative. Kyle Potter.
Do you need my glasses?
I've got some here, but I'm just trying to be tough here. Kyle Porter is a rancher. He's the livestock representative. Tim Freiss from the CWMU. Evan Vickers is elected official. Gary Nielsen is from the Central Region RAC. And Wade Heaton, who's the president of the CWMU Association, is a CWMU representative.
So Evan's the elected official.
Yes.
Is he also a state representative or a senator?
Yeah, he was the only one that wasn't in attendance in the meeting because he had commitments with the legislature when we had that. So everybody else was there.
Scott, I missed a bit on the broadmouth problem this year. Did you say that the committee was recommending probation?
Yes. They didn't recommend any action. It just, they recommended, it was written down as probation, but not take action. The division monitor them and any further complaints, so.
I'm trying to remember the process. I thought if there was going to be a probation, then that came to the board. Do you have any over that rule?
And I was, I checked with Barney Bush on this, and he said if there's no action taken, he said the board doesn't,
In other words, they want them on unofficial probation.
It's more like a warning type thing. Yeah, so, okay. That's what Marty told me. He said if they recommend action, you know, like suspension of a COR or something like that, then.
But if they wanted a formal probation, then that comes to the board.
To the board,
done that
right.
Yes,
that's correct.
Okay.
So. That's right, isn't it?
Okay. Any other questions or comments?
Just let me make one comment.
Sure.
If I could, and this just thanking Scott for standing up and being the acting section chief for the wildlife section, and I forgot to announce that Bill Bates is our section chief for the wildlife section, and he started 2 days ago, and he's nose barely above water right now. So anyway, thanks Scott for stepping up again.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This is a tough road.
When will Bill's position be filled then? Or is it been
filled? It will be announced shortly. Well, I think we're working on
it
now.
It's been announced. Yeah. Closing date's the 9th, so it'll be sometime after that.
We're rapidly trying to go through these positions and get everybody in place. It's been a struggle. The other thing I wanted to do too was thank Blair and Jason and Lindy and Stacy and John for presenting today and doing a good job. Thank you guys.
Very good. Do you have any update, Mike, on the Quagga Muskie?
No, I don't. Mike or Rory, have you? I was on last week. Are there any new developments with regard to Quagga?
No,
not in the last week.
Your girl on strawberries stopped me twice.
Did she?
Did a good job.
Heather. Yeah.
And we're last week. Was she doing a good job?
Really?
Yeah. Okay, Miss Stacy, did you get things organized?
Absolutely.
I bet you
Mike
did.
Is out of the archery range right now waiting for you guys to come out and shoot your foot. So let's go.
Got safety glasses and
everything. He's got everything that he needs. Just set up right down here at the archery range.
Hey, Scott. Good job, man.
Thank you.